Anytime we mess up here.
Here, y'all just assume it's not my fault. I'm a victim. All right. I didn't. Oh, I'll tell you the answers. Okay, if you look on the back at the timeline, you've seen this before. If you were here at the first of the book of Daniel, same thing. You can see the little black names of the minor prophets scattered through there. You kind of see the ones that were before the captivity and the ones that were after the captivity, the ones that were during the return to Jerusalem. Everybody found Haggai? See Haggai there? Yeah. All right, you can see he is during the return of the Jews that went back to Jerusalem to build the temple and to build the city. So that's where the book, the setting of the book. So you can see that kind of where we're at as far as other events in the timeline as well. This morning I want to give you just a couple of thoughts about the background of this book. The book is written in 520 B.C. over a four-month period. You can see from the timeline that it gives us in the book that it's about a four-month period. 18 years prior to this time, in 538 B.C., is about a year after the Medes and Persians took over the Babylonian Empire. You remember we studied about that in the book of Daniel when the handwriting was on the wall with Belshazzar. And that night he was killed and the Medes and Persians came in. And he died there. A year later, Cyrus, who was the king of the Persians, although Babylon was ruled by his subordinate, Darius, but a year later, Cyrus issues a decree allowing the Jews to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And Cyrus, if you read, I think it's in the book of Ezra, if I remember right, he sends with them to help them a lot of stuff, a lot of gold, a lot of silver that was in the treasury there in Babylon. And I'm assuming that a lot of that was the very stuff that Belshazzar had brought out so he could drink from it and mock it and et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of this stuff is now taken out and is sent back with the Jews as they go back to build the temple. In addition to that, he makes arrangements, and there was, I'm sure, a lot of planning that went into this. It wasn't just they all grabbed a picnic lunch one day and said, hey, let's leave, and took off. Now, there are over 40,000 men, and you can see this from the book of Ezra itself, in addition to other servants and I think the women and the young children. But he makes arrangements to get some wood from Lebanon and have it brought over there. So a lot of went into all this. This was in 538 B.C. So they get there. And about 2 years later, in 536 B.C., the foundation of the temple had been laid. And then they begin to see some trouble. Hardships come in various ways. They begin to be discouraged and defeated. And there were some, what I'm calling in quotes, neighbors. Those countries or people who lived nearby came over while they were working and said, hey, we want to join you. We've been wanting to worship your God, and we want to join you. And the Jews said, no, don't think so. Now, why would they say that? I think because they had discernment as to the fact that these people really had no interest in worshiping the one true God. And they knew that they were not to intermingle and assimilate themselves with pagan people who worship false gods. So when that took place and they would not assimilate with these people, then they found out the real heart of these people. You can see this from the book of Esther as well. The people sent a message back to Cyrus, or perhaps Darius at this point, and this is a different Darius, sent word back to him saying, hey, did you know, or you're aware, and this is my paraphrase obviously, were you aware that these people came here and said that you sent them here and they're building, rebuilding this city? And actually they're just building the temple. Rebuilding this city, and this city was one that was gave the world fits and was caused everyone trouble in years past, and here they are doing it again. We just want to make sure you're aware that this is going on. And so Darius, or Cyrus, maybe Xerxes, sends word back, says, hey, I wasn't aware of that. I checked into it, and yes, that is, Jerusalem was the place that will just cause every nation around in grief. So I'm issuing an order to cease and desist, to quit doing the work on the city. So he sends the word back to these pagan people, and they get it, and they rush over to the Jews and tell them. So they quit work on the temple. 16 years goes by, and God raises up Haggai and Zechariah as to give a message to his people, and that's where we'll read in the book of Haggai. Haggai, in this short book, two chapters and 38 verses or so, Haggai delivers four messages. And you see I've got them listed there. It gives the day, the month, and the year. The year is in reference to the reign of Darius. You see the four messages that are given. And we'll talk about them for a week or two. Not won't be a very long period of time. But I want us to look at just the first two verses. And I just want to give you just briefly, I don't think we'll spend a whole lot of time here this morning, but just some thoughts about the context and the background of what I just have given you. Okay, let's read the first two verses. In the second year of King Darius, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to Haggai, the prophet, to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehoshadak, the high priest, say, thus says the Lord of hosts, say, this people says, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. So here's my paraphrase of those two verses. God comes to Haggai. He comes to him in the first day of the sixth month, of the second year of the reign of King Darius. He tells Haggai to say to the leaders, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah. Zerubbabel was an appointed governor of that area by the Medes and the Persians. And to Joshua, Jehoshadak, the son of Jehoshadak, the high priest. So God gives a message, a word to these two men in particular, because they're the leaders of the Jews. Particularly, he goes to the top, gives them the message, and he gives it through Haggai. And here's what God says. He says, the people are saying. Here's what you are saying. The time is just not right for us to build this temple. It's just not working out. Apparently, this wasn't the right time. That's what they're saying. Okay. Now, we're going to stop right there and talk just about that idea. And I want to talk to you about dreams that you may have, goals that you may set for yourself and for your life. And you can apply them to material goals, material dreams, and then there's nothing necessarily wrong with having plans and goals to accomplish something materially and that kind of stuff. I'm not saying those things are wrong. But there are far better goals that you can have for your life than those kinds of things. We need a goal because, for no other reason than we are a Christian. We need a goal. We need to be driven to walk with God. We need to be compelled by something within us to live a godly life. For men to be godly men and lead their family. For women to be godly women and to walk beside their husbands in leading their family and in raising their children and training their children. Those type of goals ought to be at the forefront of our hearts and our minds, and they ought to be there from the time we are converted until we die. I want you to think about these people. They have been in captivity for 70 years. And apparently, it's not that they, I don't want to say they have not forgotten that they were in captivity for 7 years. What I want to say is they have been reminded that they have been in captivity for 70 years. Because in this day, 520 BC, some young man who is 20 years old is 50 years removed from that captivity. He knows nothing else but living in Babylonian captivity. But he does know it. And why does he know it? Because he has been taught. His people, these Jewish people, will not let their posterity forget who they are and where they came from. 70 years ago was 1951. Is there any great unaccomplished thing that all of us wish we could go back to 1951 and see the world do something different? I'm sure there is. But there is nothing in my mind that makes me want to go back and finish something that started in 1951. I just don't know of anything. But these people did. They knew from their history that they were diligently taught by their parents and their grandparents that what happened 70 years ago. And they were given this dream. And when the opportunity presented itself through Cyrus, I think that there was great joy at the opportunity that was given to them to return. They could envision what could be accomplished. You can read the book of Ezra, which I always looked at Ezra as being a dull book that just said, you know, this number and that number and all these things. There's some good information there. And Ezra talks about all of these things. And he mentions the guys that were there as they were building this foundation for the temple. And when it was completed, he mentions the fact that there were some people there who came from Jerusalem and were taken to Babylon. There were some 70 and 80 year old men there. He talks about their weeping for joy at being able to come back and to participate in this event. So they had dreams. Now I want to tell you something about my dreams. This is the first point. Every dream begins with glorious expectations. Have you ever had big plans to accomplish something? And man, they start out with glorious expectations. You don't think of dreaming things that fail. You don't think, I'm going to get married and I'm going to have some kids and by golly, my son's going to be the awfulest, horriblest, evil person in the world. No. Our envision of our sons before they were born and our daughters is that they will be loving and cute and obedient, and they'll memorize scripture, and they'll walk with the Lord, and they'll marry a beautiful young girl and live happily ever after. Is that kind of the way it is? That's the way it was with me and everybody I know. Every dream that we have has glorious expectations. We don't dream of desiring things that just go awful. We don't dream and have great visions of going bankrupt, right? We have great visions of nice things. And the Jews were that way. I think when they had the opportunity to go back to Jerusalem, they had expectations of rebuilding this temple, Solomon's temple in all its glory. The second point is this, that every dream begins with few expectations of hard work. Yeah, we know it's going to be hard. We know we're going to have to work at it. We know it's going to mean a lot of sweat and tears and all that kind of good stuff. But somehow in our mind, when you balance that against our newfound zeal, there's no way that this hard work will ever dampen my zeal for my dreams. Right? Here are 40,000 men, full of zeal. They're backed by the Persian king. They have all the details mapped out as to how to accomplish their goal, rebuilding Solomon's temple. There is no way I can think in their mind that they think we cannot accomplish this. They, for sure, it could be done. Number three, few dreams are accomplished without some rough spots along the way. Usually, anything worth accomplishing is hard work. No matter what it is, no matter if it's material things or spiritual things. I don't know if y'all have figured that out about being married or not, but it don't take long to figure it out when you get married. I remember my neighbor years ago, his daughter got married, and we were talking, and I'd been married, I don't know, 5 or 8 years at the time. I wasn't one to be talking about marital advice to anybody, actually. But he was an older guy, and we were talking, and his daughter and her husband were fixing to get married, and he tells me, he says, you know, you can only live so long on love. And what he meant by that was his electric bill is going to come due. And the water bill. And you're going to have medical emergencies. And your truck's going to break down. And all these kinds of things. And it's going to take a little more than just love to get by. It's going to take some hard work. And it's that way with anything. It's that way with marriage. It's that way with going to church with folks like me. Right? It's hard. It's hard work to accomplish something worthwhile. Number four, few dreams are lived without the humbling experience of being willing to be helped. We are here in this place together. The Jews, and I don't mean to make an exact comparison in any of these things, but when the Jews came, those 40,000 people, to Jerusalem, to build this temple. They were there 40,000 strong. They could not and will not accomplish their task if they are 40,000 individuals. They have to be together. They have to be united. And then again, it's like that with anything. It's like that in a home. A husband and wife have to work together. They have to have the same values. They have to have the same beliefs, at least enough in the important things. They need to both be pursuing and heading the same direction. It's like you've heard me give this illustration before. Here's a husband and here's a wife. They're individuals. They look at things their own way. Some of those things they look at the same way, about the same issue, but some different. But if they are committed Christians and their number one objective is to walk with God, and you picture God as being there and they are here, as the years go by, they're not heading for each other. They're pursuing God. So here they are. They're pursuing God. What happens? They get closer together as time goes by. That's where we ought to be. It is hard for a husband and wife to be on the same page and to be united and to be one flesh with a different God. It's impossible. You've heard the saying, united we stand, divided we fall. It's been around a long time. I don't know, is that Abraham Lincoln maybe that said that? Somebody. We've heard it before, but it's true, isn't it? Then the last point is this. These people, we saw in verse 2, have quit work on the temple. They got the foundation laid, and they quit. Because the government told them to quit. They were discouraged, and they quit. For 16 years, they have laid it down. And then Haggai comes along. Because God has spoken to Haggai. And God tells Haggai, we're going to see all this a little bit later. I'm not going to go through all the details. But God tells Haggai to go to the leaders and tell them, here's what I've been hearing from the people. Just the wrong time. Can't be done now. Darius told us to quit. Xerxes told us to stop. We're going to see that God tells Haggai to tell the people to get up and finish the task. It's interesting. He did not tell Haggai to tell the people to go check with Darius to see if you could start again. Now, we're going to be careful how we make application in our own day. But that's what he said. Or that's what he didn't say. And they begin work. And here's what happened. We can see this in the book of Ezra. They start working. Some of these same busybodies that were around 16 years ago are still there. And they come up and they say, hey, what are you doing? Who told you you could work on this? What is your name? Give us your name. Because they're preparing a report to carry to Darius. They wouldn't tell their name. They said, the God of heaven told us to do this. That's all they would tell them. So the people got all together and they head toward or send a message back to Darius. And they said, these people are working on this temple. And they told us that you gave them all the gold and silver. They got lots of gold and silver stuff here. And they said you said that you gave it to them and sent it back here with them. You might want to check your treasury and see if you got anything missing. Now here's how God works, or how he worked here. Darius, or Xerxes, whoever the king was, they go and check it out, and they got the records, The Medes and Persians have detailed records of all this kind of stuff. They go back and they see where Cyrus issued a decree that all this could take place. They saw where in the decree Cyrus gives them the gold and stuff from the treasury. They saw that this, yeah, that's, they told you right. And the king sends back a message and he says, we checked it out. And yes, there was a decree for them to go. There was a decree to give them the gold and the silver, to provide them all the stuff that you need. And then he adds these words. So you see to it that they get all the help they need. If they need you to do something, you take care of it for me. You reckon that went over real well? Here is God. First, he tells the people to work. Pick up your tools and go back to work. Apparently in defiance of the government's order. And then he changes the heart of the ruler, of the king, to aid them again and to put to shame their enemies. Now, that's the background for the book of Haggai. We will kind of pick that up next time we get going. But here's something I want to leave with you. It's something we're going to have prayer time here in just a little bit. But in our day, in my life, Susan told y'all how long we've been married a few weeks ago. Y'all remember how long that was? 40. I was hoping somebody remembers, so I'd know. No, I'm just joking. 42. 42 years we've been married. When we were married, the world was a different place. It was a different place. It was different in a lot of ways that were better. I guess if I could trade the society in which we live with the one back then, I'd trade. I'd go back to people being like they were, society as a whole being like they were then. But there is one thing that I believe is not good. And that is this, that it was easier in 1979 when we got married to be a Christian in name only. You could go to church, you could fit in, and nobody would ever know the difference. Because most people were halfway moral. Most people kind of had the same values inside the church and outside the church. So you could just kind of fit in. In the 42 years that have passed since then, I can look back and see, I didn't see it as we were headed that direction, but I can look back and see that where we are now and where we are heading at an accelerated pace is that more than likely we will not be able to just casually be a Christian. Somewhere along the way, more than likely in the next few years, somebody is going to call your hand. Laws are going to be passed that restrict Christians' practice of their religion. And things are going to be hard. Our dreams of living a Christian life are going to be severely challenged. I want to ask us. You can take it personally, you can take it individually. But I want to ask us, as a group of people that meet together, what's going to be our excuse when that day comes? These people had an excuse. The time's not right. just not the right time. It's not the right place. It's too hard. Nobody will help us. Just ain't going to work. Some people have an excuse, a reason they don't endeavor to work at reading this. Because it's too hard to understand. You are not going to understand this without work. Hard work. If you expect to read the book of Haggai one time, and it'll take you 6 minutes to do it. You read it one time and invest 6 long minutes at reading this book. One time, you're not going to be any better off than you were before you started. You're not going to get it in one reading. I want to challenge you to start reading the book of Haggai. 6 minutes it takes to read it through one time. I challenge you to read it 30 times and tell me you don't understand it. You will. You don't have to get commentaries. You don't have to get anything else. Just read it over and over and over again. And pretty soon you're going to know that on the second page over here on this column is verse 13 that said such and such. You're going to know back over here at the top left corner is where this statement was made. And you're going to know it's the 24th day of the 6th month or the 7th month or the 9th month. You're going to know all this stuff before you get to it. Invest something in studying. It's hard work. Some people have an excuse, they're too old. I know. That's my new excuse. I'm too old. Some people are too young. My big toe hurts. Or here's the most dangerous one of all. The Lord told me, fill in the blank. My marriage is so hard. It's too hard. It's too hard to work this marriage. The Lord told me to leave. The Lord told me this. The Lord told me that. You ought to be careful, and I ought to be careful, about putting words in the Lord's mouth. It's a good thing that God is a merciful God. Because He has been said to have said a lot of things over the years that he never said. Well, here we are. 2021, August the 29th. In our world, we've extended some prayer time. In our world, we see what's going on in Afghanistan. We see what's going on in our country. See what's going on with our politicians. We see what's going on with the COVID stuff. We see what's going on with all of these things. And they touch us. If nothing else, they worry us. We've got people who are not here today because they're sick or because they are concerned about the virus and all that those things. We are being touched in many ways with things that worry us, that bother us. And beside all of that, behind all of that, on top of all of that, we are still called to be Christian. We are still called to do right. We're still called to be a light in this world. Still called to be salt to the earth. Are we going to do it? Are we going to hide? Let's have a time of prayer, and I want to just ask you to pray. We're not going to take requests necessarily. We're not going to have share time. There's not going to be requests. If you have something that needs to be on the prayer list, it's up to you to get it, that information to Tim. But you're going to think of things to pray about that I will not think of. I might think of things to pray about that you would never think of, or at least not today. So I want you to pray. Can we do that? Whoever would like to pray, begin, and I'll close this after a while.